Hi, I'm Michael Senoff, founder and CEO of HardToFindSeminars.com. For the last 5 years, I've interviewed the world's best business and marketing minds. Along the way, I've created a successful publishing business all from home from my two-car garage. When my first child was born, he was very sick, and it was then that I knew I had to have a business that I could operate from home. Now my challenge is to build the world's largest free resource for online downloadable MP3 audio business interviews. I knew I needed a site that contained strategies, solutions, and inside angles to help you live better, to save and make more money, to stay healthier, and to get more out of life. I've learned a lot in the last 5 years, and today I'm going to show you the skills you need to survive.
I think that you've got to find people that fit the culture of the company and who want an opportunity. I don't think that if you pay a low wage starting out that you're going to always end up with bad people. On the contrary, I think it's your job as an employer to sell your company and the future that it offers. The likelihood for continued employment, the likelihood for growth in the company, and the likelihood of increases in pay can be a great motivator for people.
Hi, it's Michael Senoff with Michael Senoff's HardToFindSeminars.com. The title of this interview is called How to Find and Keep Superstar Employees and Other Tips for Small Business Owners. When Tony Bass started his landscaping business more than 20 years ago, he knew a lot about landscaping, but only a little bit about running a business. So after struggling the first 5 years, he decided to do some research and analyze where his business was going wrong and what he could do to make it right. This is the story of how Tony turned his business around. You'll also hear how he created two inventions along the way while also writing a book about how to obtain and retain superstar employees. And in this hour-long interview, you'll hear his tips and tricks for hiring the best employees possible. Believe it or not, money is not always the biggest motivating factor when hiring. You'll also learn how to take an objective look at your small business, analyze where you're losing money, and calculate every missed opportunity. You'll learn three ways to advertise for employees for free. You may want to hold off on the newspaper ad until you've tried these. You'll learn what it means to be a superstar employee and how to screen out applicants to find those qualified and honest overachievers. You'll learn the best place to meet prospective employees for job interviews, when you do a group meeting, and how to talk about the pay scale. You'll learn why Tony always makes his job offers in person and in writing. You'll learn feasible benefits to set up for your employees that will keep them happy for the long run, and much, much more. Because entry-level landscapers are generally paid very little to start, Tony says he has to figure out creative ways to recruit quality people. And in this audio interview, he shares many of those ways along with other tips for making your small business the best it can be. Now let's get ready, and I hope you enjoy. Tony, first of all, how'd you start in the lawn business? Were you a kid cutting grass for money as a teenager or what?
I started a landscaping business, Michael, in 1987. So it's been a few years ago, but it was actually a college professor, a turf grass professor of mine that inspired me. He said, when you grow up one day, Tony, and you become a turf grass professional, you will really be somebody. And he said, if you really want to pursue this as a career, I suggest that you go down to the library after class is over and read some of these trade magazines and learn a little bit about this industry, because it is going to be a fast growth industry for the future.
Now, what do we mean turf grass? Are we just talking about lawns, or is it a specialty like golf courses or what?
Well, the study of turf grass would involve lawns, residential, homeowners, parks, golf courses, any place where you'd want to grow grass for leisure or for sport.
Why did he think that was going to be such a big thing? How old were you also at that time?
Well, I was a college student, 19, 20 years old, and the growth of the golf course or golf industry was driving his awareness, but also the growth of the landscaping industry. The landscaping industry has grown at double-digit rates since the late 80s and continues to grow. It's really amazing And a lot of that has to do with the fact that there's more and more people in the United States today purchasing landscape services than at any time in history. And much of that has to do with the aging baby boom population. The fact is that every time someone approaches retirement, they start thinking about the physical difficulties of maintaining and caring for their lawns and landscapes. And one of the solutions for getting rid of that physical challenge or time-consuming challenge for busy professionals is to hire that work out to a professional landscape contractor.
So this professor told you to go study up on it, and then what did you do?
I did that. I read magazines. I read stories about people that had started landscape companies and was absolutely inspired to read about how their approach to using the technical knowledge of turf grass or horticulture could be used for profit. And ultimately, what I was looking for was a way to make money. But here was a real-life example of how studying the technical side of turf grass could be used for profit. And at that point in time in my life and career, studying history or calculus or biology, I didn't see those kind of connections where there was a real life, hey, people would pay for this kind of training. So it was very, very easy for me to see how the technical competency of knowing about lawns and landscaping, irrigation, which is another thing we learned about, fertilization, weed control, pest management, and sports fields and golf courses and all these things could translate into business opportunities.
And this wasn't something where you needed to get like a license for, I mean, is it licensed now in some states?
You gotta have pesticide applicator's license. You must have business license. You must have contractor's licenses in many states to install and work on irrigation systems. In many of the states, you have to be licensed to do that.
All right, so did you start your own small landscaping business?
I started a company just a couple of weeks after graduating from the University of Georgia.
How old are you? Let me ask you that.
I'm 43.
You're 43, okay.
So I started this company just 2 weeks after college. I'd never worked at a company before. I'd never really done landscaping for anyone else. It was basically what I got exposed to in college there at the University of Georgia that gave me the basic technical background about the job. But then I became a student of the industry after graduating and began to read all that I could about the technical side of the business that I didn't feel I was competent in after graduating, and then just learn as you do it.
Do you remember your very first account?
Of course.
Man. Tell me about it.
Well, I had worked my way through the University of Georgia as a college student at a grocery store called Winn-Dixie in Athens, Georgia, and the produce manager who I worked for, a guy named Chap Cook, actually, Chap got a promotion, and he moved back near the area where I grew up. And so after I graduated, I looked this guy up, and I said, I'm going to start a landscaping business. He says, you're kidding. I said, no, I'm not. He said, man, I just bought a new house. I need some landscaping done at my house. I said, terrific, man. Let's go look at it. And so we went and looked at it, and I ended up drawing up a plan, putting together a proposal for him, and he said, yeah. Started right there.
So did you start out the right way because you had done a lot of studying, or you had the technical knowledge, but how about the business knowledge? What happened with that landscaping company? How long was it just you until you brought on your first employee?
I hired basically my college roommate to help me getting started. And, you know, that was because I knew him and because he was out of school for the summer. And he needed some money, too. So it was really convenient for him and I. But the first 5 years was really quite a struggle. And I say it's quite a struggle because finding work and getting work didn't seem to be that big of a problem. Now, there would be times that, you know, I wouldn't have as much work as others. But for the most part, just going out and doing a nice job, doing quality work, being responsive to people, showing up on time, doing what they asked you to do, providing consistency in terms of showing up when you're supposed to, acting like you got some sense when you come out to do a job, and people would just keep hiring you. But to be quite honest, it was a real struggle from a financial standpoint, and the reason was is I simply didn't have the tools I needed, the intellectual tools from a business standpoint to make my company very profitable or very large. So it was 1991 when I stumbled across a little book that you may or may not have heard of, Michael. It's called The E-Myth.
Oh, yeah.
Michael Gerber.
Sure.
And it was Michael Gerber and his wisdom that said, hey, wait a minute. You know, you've got to quit doing it. You've got to work on your business instead of in your business. You've got to work on these systems for replicating, duplicating your processes and procedures. And when I read that book by Michael Gerber, everything changed for me from a physical work standpoint, from a mental planning and preparation standpoint.
At that time, what did your company look like before you read that book, right at that time?
When I read that book, I had 9 employees. We had revenues of, oh gosh, I guess it was around $300,000 or $400,000 in sales a year, annual sales. And I was working 50 or 60 hours a week and really wasn't making near enough money to support a family and any kind of hobbies or,
right.
You know, or fun stuff outside of just doing the job every day. So it was a job, and I was the worst possible boss I could have for myself because I made myself work all kind of hours and very little pay, which is the way a lot of entrepreneurs start off.
So when you read that book, what was the first thing you did to take action to really implement what you learned in that book, systems?
First thing I did, I took a 6-month sabbatical. Took 6 months off and began to focus my effort and energy working on the business.
I mean, what did you do with your accounts and what did you tell your employees?
Well, I have to be more descriptive with my sabbatical. It was a sabbatical in that I didn't take any more clients on, and I didn't attempt to grow the company at all. I simply began to come in and let the employees that I have do the accounts that we had. Basically, it was lawn maintenance at that time, Michael. We were doing mowing and pruning and weeding and fertilizing and cleaning of leaves and or debris. People throw out trash or whatever. We'd clean it all up. And so I just said, wait a minute, before I take on one single new account, before I take on one new customer, I'm going to really study what we're doing, how we're doing it, and begin to document the processes and procedures well enough so that I know what we're doing good at and what we're not doing good at. And so when I say I took a sabbatical from working on the crew. I took a sabbatical from going out and writing estimates for new accounts. I still went to work. I still had a company, I still had employees, but I did absolutely nothing to try to grow, expand, or to obligate myself in any way that I could out in the field.
You're listening to an exclusive interview found on Michael Senoff's hardtofindseminars.com. What were some of the things that you did that you really saw was making a big difference in your business, and where were some of the biggest challenges that you were having?
It comes back to employees. The very first time that I hired an employee and sent them out to do a job without direct supervision and guidance, that is me being there, watching, pointing, participating, the results were less than perfect. The results were either they did the job too quickly without enough quality, or they did it much too quickly without enough quality.
Was this kind of like when you took your sabbatical, so you weren't really overseeing your employees, or you didn't have a manager overseeing what they were doing, and because of that, they would do a poor job?
Well, with 9 employees, we were working on 2 or 3 different job sites at a time, and so we'd have 2 or 3 crews out working, and I could never be where all the crews are at one time. So that's when the inconsistency in quality or inconsistency in production would happen. But the time that I was spending in sabbatical studying, I worked as an engineer at that point in time in my company, really doing time and motion studies, physically watching and taking copious notes of what I saw, how long it took, for example, when we would go out and fill the trucks up with fuel to go to the jobs and to have gasoline for the lawnmowers and for the string trimmers and for the hedge trimmers and the tools that we would run and operate all day. And when I began doing these time and motion studies, I learned exactly what it was really costing me in terms of man hours, which in dollars and cents cost, but also in missed revenue opportunities. One example, Michael, of a time and motion study was how long does it take to make a fuel run? Let's stop at the gas station. And I found that the average time it took for us to stop and get fuel was 10 minutes. We had 3 people on a crew, so 3 people in a truck times 10 minutes is a half of 1 man hour investment of time. Doesn't sound like a whole lot, but the fact is that the little fuel cans that we were carrying would be empty in a day or 2, And so we'd be right back at that fuel station again, filling up.
So you're doing that 15 times a month?
Yeah, we were doing it three times a week on average, sometimes more, sometimes a little less. But on average, we did three stops a week. Well, three stops a week with three men on a crew, now it wasn't 30 minutes, it was an hour and a half. And an hour and a half times 52 weeks in a year, and all of a sudden we're talking about 75 man hours. Well, my goal from the time and motion study was to figure out a way that we could reduce the number of fuel stops from three times per week to one time per week. And I did that by designing some onboard fuel tanks that would carry a large enough quantity of fuel so that we would be able to make that one stop a week and not run out of fuel until the truck had actually ran out of fuel.
Was that your very first idea for leveraging time with these trucks that you do and design?
Yes.
That's very interesting. Okay, so you made a modification to your truck to carry enough fuel, which would eliminate all these fuel stops.
Actually, that was one of my first observations. And then the next observation was how much time we were spending doing things like this, looking for tools. You know, get to a job site and, for example, needed to change a blade on an edger. An edger is a tool we use for trimming the driveways and sidewalks and things like this, curbs around the property. Need to change an edger blade, but you can't find the correct wrench. And so we'd have to dig around in the toolbox or try to locate the toolbox under supplies that were already stacked on the truck. So things were a little disorganized. And so when I started looking at how much time we spent each day, either looking for tools or supplies that we needed, you know, oh, man, I can't find the scissor shears. Where are the scissor shears at, Jeff? And then, you know, you have to go walk across the yard, find Jeff, to ask him what he did with them last time. Well, it became crystal clear that having a good tool organization system would improve productivity. So I began thinking about that and then made up a list of all the tools that we would need and established a set defined inventory of those common tools. And from there, we looked at the process of driving around town. And at the time, the company was operating with pickup trucks and trailers. And these trailers, you know, you would hook up to the back end of the truck and then you'd tow them around town. And what became crystal clear is that most of the guys that operated the pickup truck with a trailer would have difficulty during the day maneuvering those pickup trucks and trailers around town. They would either be on a busy street and need to back out of a driveway into a neighborhood, or they would get into some tight urban area and have to go down around a block in order to have enough room to get back and position the truck properly at the property, or they would go to lunch. And rather than just parking in a parking spot, you know, that's close to the restaurant, they had to park over in the mall area adjacent where there was some open areas large enough for the pickup truck and trailer. And so all these little things would just rob you of time. It was robbing my company of time day in and day out.
Were you paying your employees by the hour?
Yes.
Okay. The clock is ticking. You got all these employees, and you know they're being paid by the hour, and it's killing you to seeing them wasting your money.
None of the stuff that they were doing was intentional.
I know.
It's just the way they thought it was, the way things were at the company, and so it's just part of their daily grind. But at the same time, unintentionally, and I didn't really know it at the time, but when you make it hard on somebody to do their job, whether that's locating the proper tool to do a job or finding a property to go visit and do some work at, if you make it hard on people, you give them equipment that breaks down or doesn't work properly or doesn't work safely, it demotivates them. It does absolutely nothing for employee retention, for people taking pride in their work and wanting to stick with the company.
Now, that makes sense. That's interesting. Give me one other idea of a system you put in place based on these studies of time and efficiency.
Well, probably the biggest impact that we had on the company was paying very careful attention as to what we were doing each morning and each afternoon. I began to call it the morning circus and the afternoon shutdown. Now, the morning circus was always when the guys would come into work, the guys would come into the office to get their assignment for the day, and then they would load the truck with the tools and supplies they would need to go out and do the day's work. And then they would return in the afternoon. They would take the tools and supplies that weren't used off of the vehicle, off of the trailers that we towed, put it into a shop in a warehouse area where it could be locked up and stored overnight out of the weather. And then it'd come right back in the next morning, and we would do that whole thing again. We would load the tools and put them onto the truck, put them onto the trailer, get supplies that were necessary, and then we would leave for the day. It was interesting that morning circus always took about two times the amount of time that it would take to shut down in the afternoon. And you can imagine a couple of reasons why. You know, people are always more anxious in the afternoon to get off of work than they are to get started on work in the morning. But just that process is, wait a minute, why does it take 20 minutes to get ready to go in the morning, but only takes 10 minutes to shut down in the afternoon? What if we could eliminate starting up and shutting down altogether? What an impact would that make? And all of a sudden we say, well, this is a 30-minute problem. 20 minutes in the morning, 10 minutes in the afternoon, 30 minutes of time. Well, it's not just 30 minutes of time, because at that point in time in my company, there was 9 employees.
And what were you paying them per hour, just an average?
An average, say, $10 an hour.
Okay, 9 employees, and that's $90 an hour, so that's $45 a day.
That's right, $45 a day. This is what I would like to say. It wasn't that $90 a day just in cost, you see, because our billable rate at the time was $30 a man hour. And so it cost me $45, but I missed being able to bill $15.
Yeah, your opportunity cost.
Right. And so you have to add those numbers together. I'm sorry, it's not $30, but it was 9 times $30, or $270. And so we missed billing $135. For that half an hour. See, you start off with a negative 45, right? Well, when you say you're going to take away a negative and add a positive, minus a negative is another positive. It's a little trick of math, right? But it says negative 45 plus $135, you end up with a $180 impact.
And that doesn't even include ongoing automatic billing, you know, with customers that you could have had during that time.
That's right. So basically, you know, $180 a day and financial impact in a company that works in this part of the country where I'm at, about 220 days a year outside, 230 maybe. You're talking about almost a $40,000 swing in profitability and revenue. It seems really clear and obvious today, reflecting on it, but I assure you, it was not that clear at that time to me, and it's not that clear to other people in that position today. Starting a company and trying to get the people organized and trying to get the systems in place to reduce wasted time.
I had read you have a couple patents. What did this lead you to develop? Can you tell me about these trucks? How far after these studies and the realization of these huge wasted resources and time did it take you to develop this truck and to systematize this whole thing for your company?
Well, two patents, really. One is on a hydraulically operated loading ramp that becomes a rear door for an enclosed cargo van type truck. In 1991, when I began on this sabbatical, I had no idea where I was going with this, but ultimately decided that I needed to eliminate the use of trailers in my company to haul equipment around. And what I wanted to do was to get the trailer eliminated, but I wanted to put all the gear into the back of a truck. But I needed to have a big truck, enough room to carry all the tools and supplies. And if you're familiar with commercial vehicles, commercial trucks, they're kind of high off the ground, Michael. They are cargo vans, or some 36 to 42 inches off the ground, medium-duty classified trucks to carry enough weight, like we're talking about with commercial mowers and trimmers and blowers and shovels and rakes and all this gear. They're off the ground a bit. And Dad and I got out there in the backyard garage and began tinkering with building loading ramps on the back of a truck that I purchased. And over time, we figured out how to make a ramp turn into a rear door for the truck and do it in a neat and compact fashion. So it provided security, provided a loading ramp, and it made it easy and safe for people to get gear in and out of the back of a truck that's, you know, about waist high off the ground.
All right, so you got a patent on this device?
Yeah, it's called the Hydra Ramp.
Is it a utility patent or like a design patent?
You know, it's a utility patent for something that we've done.
Is it real unique in the industry? No one else has anything like this?
Right. We're sole source for it at Super Lawn Trucks.
Wow, that's great.
Yeah, and then we got a second patent on some of the tool storage devices that we built to go on the inside of the enclosed truck body. The way we stored our shovels and rakes and hand tools turned out to be another novel idea. Pretty cool.
That is great. So you've got this, what are they called, Super Lawn Trucks?
Super Lawn, L-A-W-N, Trucks.
Super Lawn Trucks. Why don't you tell me what's one of these trucks going to do? Let's say I'm in the landscaping business. I've got three or four guys. I'm doing the trailer. I'm experiencing all the challenges that you had and the time wasting. If I got one of these trucks, what's it going to do for me?
Well, the first thing we're going to do is the truck serves as a warehouse on wheels. The truck becomes the warehouse. That is, you eliminate the need for storage buildings or warehouse space in the company when you use an enclosed truck. Number two, when you use an enclosed truck and an enclosed truck body, you create the opportunity for billboard size advertising or marketing on the sides of the vehicle. Think about the side of a pickup truck, Michael. You've got a very limited amount of space that you can place your name and phone number and perhaps website address. But on a cargo van, much like a UPS truck or a Federal Express truck you might see, much bigger areas to put your company information. Would you agree?
Great idea. And you see trucks like that who do nothing but advertise, but you've got your own mobile billboard.
That's right. So first idea is to eliminate the need for warehouse. And when you do that, you create a lower overhead scenario for a business owner. Second thing you do is you put signs on your vehicle that are very large, which is very prominent for people to be able to find your contact information, namely your number, your list of services. And then the next thing you do to help innovate in your company, to help your company get more done every day, is that you keep the tools really well organized on the inside of the truck. So we get customized tool organization on the inside of this enclosed truck body, which helps your crews all day long, making their job easier and safer, that is, because you've got a neat, easy-to-use loading ramp on the rear of the truck, walk in and out of, to carry gear in and out of. But the thing that ends up being a huge benefit is that you get to lock your tools away and keep them secure. And one of the real difficult issues, if you're a contractor today, is that people will steal stuff off of your truck or trailer or anything that's not locked up. And so the security aspect of having everything inside and locked up usually keeps people from exposing themselves to 2, 3, maybe 5 or 6 theft incidents each year.
Okay. Can we talk a little bit about this most recent book you put together, 50 Ways to Find, Recruit, Hire, and Retain Superstar Employees?
Love to talk about the book.
All right. Why did you write this book, and who's going to benefit from it by reading it?
Well, I wrote the book simply because in working with more than 100 business owners as their private consultant, one of the biggest challenges, one of the most time-consuming conversations we always have is, how am I going to find good people? How am I going to find good people to do the work of my company, even when I'm not there? And it's so hard in any business, but it's particularly hard for people in the landscape contracting business. Let me give you a statistic. The United States Department of Labor tracks the average wages, that is the pay scales, Michael, for 825 occupations in America. Well, guess what? If you're an entry-level landscape gardener in the United States of America, and this is your career choice, your first job, you rank about 750 out of 825 occupations in America in terms of pay. So there's 750 other job opportunities in America that pay more than entry-level landscaping. And there's only about 75 jobs in America that pay less. So you have to be a very creative recruiter. You have to be very creative to find people willing to take those entry-level jobs, those low-paying jobs. And what was amazing to me is that after I began documenting the process of finding people, how universal it would be for other people, regardless of whether they operate a contracting company or a bakery or if they are the human resources professional at a university. It really doesn't matter. Finding people is a science, just like math is a science. There are certain things you can do to increase the likelihood that people will come to you looking for work.
What's the most common mistake business owners make when it comes to finding a superstar employee?
Well, I think that the biggest mistake they make is that they think that someone must have experience in order to be a superstar. They think that somebody must have to have or must have had some experience doing the job that you want to hire them to do. And in my opinion, that ends up being a mistake.
What do you think the most important element is in a superstar employee when you're looking or interviewing?
The thing that's going to be so important to get superstars as opposed to just average employees is finding people that are going to be honest, be punctual, be energetic, be creative, and cooperative, easy to get along with. These are traits of a person that has absolutely nothing to do with the technical training that they have had or they have not had. Those are the skills and the traits of a real superstar. Those people that show up to work on time, those people that do their job consistently, day in and day out, with a great level of enthusiasm, that take pride in their work. It really doesn't matter the technical training that someone has. If they're going to be a superstar, they're going to have those traits. Would you agree with that?
I would. Can you take me through an example? Like, let's say you've got your existing companies. Let's say you got another truck you want to put out there for new accounts, and you need to find another three or four employees and maybe kind of do it in the position of maybe a smaller landscape. Over the years, what you've learned as being the most effective and efficient ways to locate, find, and qualify good employees. Tell me the process that one would do that would give them the best outcome.
I'd like to start by saying that in order to get and find real superstars, you know, it's kind of like that old saying, in order to find a prince, you got to kiss a lot of frogs. Well, in order to find those superstars, you need to have a lot of applicants in your company. And so what we're going to need to do is we're going to need to deploy a number of strategies or tactics for building awareness about your company and the jobs that you have available or that you need to fill. And the very first thing that I recommend that owners or business managers do to find employees is to begin by making sure that everyone who works in the company is aware that you need employees and exactly what kind of employees you need. You see, the very best recruiters that you can ever have for your business is going to be people that are already satisfied working there. And so there's no rocket science here by any means, Michael, but the fact is that what I recommend the first thing an employer do is to post the job opening at the time clock, if they have a time clock, a break room, if that's where people gather in the company, but not just internally. Post that job also at the front door of the business. You know, how many businesses have you went by as you ride down the street and you see a help wanted sign? You know, help wanted signs are a great way to recruit. You do it every time you start to fill a new position. Because ideally, you would ask your employees to help you find just the right person and describe that person to them so that they will know exactly what you're looking for. For example, if you're in the contracting business and you're looking for someone to work on a lawn maintenance crew, I would describe the person as being someone who's physically fit, who loves working outside, who loves being outdoors, someone who may have hobbies that takes them outdoors frequently, such as hunting, fishing, or playing sports outside. And just by being a little bit more precise that you're looking for someone that's young, energetic, someone that is maybe looking for a chance or an opportunity to do something new and different, you start to get people to think on a more specific level than, hey, who do I know who's asked me about a job? You start to define what people look like, they're more likely to go out and help you find that person, the one that's likely to become a superstar. But we don't give up on the sign out in front that says help wanted. We get a little more creative. We say, how many ways could we ask for people that might be interested in working with us? And this is a great example. If you own a contracting company, you may or may not have a retail facility. You know, a lot of guys, whether they're landscape contractors, Michael, or electrical contractors, or plumbing contractors, or flooring contractors, how many of those guys have a retail storefront? A lot of them don't. So how do you put a help wanted sign out front? Well, one of the things you can do is you can put a help wanted sign on the side of your vehicle. You know, simply putting a now hiring sign on the side of your truck or on the side of your car, if that's what you drive, is a great way to build awareness. How much does it cost? It doesn't cost very much to put a help wanted sign on a vehicle. In fact, depending on, you know, the size of a magnetic sign on the side of a vehicle, you can buy one of those for under $50. We'll compare that to what it would cost to run a help wanted ad in the local newspaper. Depending on the market that you're in, you could spend hundreds, maybe even $1,000 on a help wanted ad, right? But kind of a little sign on your vehicle that you display during times that you need people can increase the number of applications that you are going to get.
For more exclusive interviews on business, marketing, advertising, and copywriting, go to Michael Senoff's hardtofindseminars.com.
All right, that's a great idea. What are some other low-cost ways other than running newspaper ads? And what's your opinion on running newspaper ads? Do you get a lot of applicants? I mean, or is it just money that doesn't need to be spent?
I think newspaper ads work. You do get applicants that come in, and it is a strategy that you can certainly deploy anytime you need to get people. But I just wouldn't start with that. I would try to do five things that cost me almost zero before I spent a few hundred dollars on a newspaper ad. Here's another really simple thing. I said, okay, put a sign on the side of your vehicle. Put a sign on the front door of your office by your time clock. Talk to your employees about the position that's available. But here's something that's very easy. If you have a business card, and I bet you do, what is on the back side of your business card? Now, I know you're a marketing consultant. You probably know that using the back of your business card is a smart thing to use that real estate to further advertise your company. But when's the last time you got a business card from somebody and the back of it was blank? Well, what's wrong with having a job opening posted on the back of your business cards? What's wrong with having a business card for your employees that's given to each employee that has that brief job description or overview of that job, including its pay rate, right on that business card? So you've got the contact information, that is where your company is, and the basics of the job right on the business card. And how about this? What about putting job applications on the truck, in the vehicle, making them easy to give out to people who you may encounter?
Good idea. So that's fine. You can get the applications coming in, but isn't it a very time-consuming process going through these? Take me through your system of how you qualify these applicants. Is there anything special on your actual application that gives you some real key indicators whether they're going to be good or no good that streamline the process? Take me through that process from the time these applications come in. How are they sent in? When someone calls a phone number, do they get a live person or a recorded message giving them instructions? Tell me about that system.
All right. The application process starts off with you getting the basic information about the person. Most job applications are very similar, and you got a place to put your name and your address and your phone number and then your previous employment, right? Well, there's some other things that you can do to help you begin to screen people before you ever sit down and talk to them, and it's called a basic skills test. A basic skills test can test someone for some of the things that you know a person has to be good at or competent at before you would consider hiring them. Now, basic skills tests could include things like this. Math questions, okay? 25 plus 25 equals 75 minus 45 equals multiplication and division. If you're in the contracting business like I was for years, we tested people, basic skills tests, on things like measuring square footage of lawn, length times width, or so we'd say calculate the area of this square, calculate the area of this triangle. Not a word problem, calculating man hours. You and I talked some about man hours today and what an impact it can make on the profitability of a company. Jeff and Johnny go to Mrs. Jones' home to mow the lawn. They begin at 9 a.m. and they depart and leave the site at 10:30 a.m. How many man hours are used on the Jones account? Well, this, you witness someone working in an unsafe manner. What do? Just an open-ended question that shows something about a person's judgment.
That's good.
Yeah, the technical issues of, for example, name three evergreen shrubs under 6 feet in height. Select the turf grasses from the list of plants below. There's very specific questions that will tell you right away if someone has technical training in the area, but also the basic things that would apply to anything from running a cash register to filling out paperwork accurately for the work that you're doing. So a basic skills test is one of the very first things, the most simple thing you can do to help you begin to evaluate a person before you ever spend any of your time talking to them or interviewing them.
All right, so you'll get the applications and you'll look through them and you'll identify which ones look pretty good.
That's right.
And then what?
And then, you know, there's something that almost I have found only real professionals do this. A lot of business owners don't take the time to simply review the references before you spend spend any time interviewing somebody. If you will simply pick up the phone and call the references, you will find out immediately if the people actually had the jobs that they said they did and the people's opinions of them. Because if you'll take the time and simply say, would you rehire that person again if they came back in your company, you'll know right away whether or not, and they go, oh, are you kidding? He's available? Well, boom. They're going to tell you more about the person than an interview will.
Don't you find that when people put references, they're always going to put people who are going to give them a good reference? I mean, why would they put someone who would give a questionable report to you?
Don't be surprised, brother. I promise you. I have seen so many applications in my career that people don't always do that. They may think that they had a good work history with someone, but the fact is that calling an employer is a smart thing to do. And just because you put the name on there doesn't mean they're going to necessarily give you a good reference. Or, you know, here's a really simple thing. The actual time of employment. Sometimes people fudge the amount of time they spend in a job. They may say they spent, you know, a year and a half there, and they really only spent 6 months there. Seen people stretch the truth about their position in the company, what they were really responsible for. And I've seen that probably more than anything.
So what do you do? When you see someone stretching the truth or lying, do you continue or they're done?
I'm not going to waste my time with that person. That person has demonstrated without any remorse or hesitation to distort the truth. So there's no reason to even talk to someone like that.
All right, so let's say you find a good one that really looks like there's some potential. What do? You call them back and invite them in for another interview?
The ideal situation is you would invite them into your office. If you have an office, invite them into your office to take some, what I would call, pre-hire evaluation tests. And I had no idea, Michael, that such tests could be used or were even available until I actually hired a human resources expert to come in and help me in my company. But I learned about a test called the ERI, or the Employee Reliability Interview. And by having an applicant answer 83 true-false questions, a little hand test, they would read the question, they would circle in true or false. From taking this 83-question true-false exam, I would be able to enter that data for the answers to their questions into a little piece of software and get a printout that gives me, believe it or not, the likelihood of this person to abuse drugs and alcohol, the likelihood of this person to work well as others, the likelihood for this person to stay in a job for any period of time. And immediately you learn about the person's character from this little exam.
All right, so you are using personality profiling.
Absolutely. This test is so inexpensive. I think it costs about $15, but it absolutely tells the truth about whether this person has the honesty that you would want to work in your company.
Okay, so you have them take this personality profiling test. Now, what would you suggest? Let's say I'm a landscaper. I don't have an office. Where would I meet the guy?
What I recommend really small clients that don't have an office, I recommend that they meet at a coffee shop or a Staples or Home Depot, something like that, where it's kind of a business environment, and give it to them there. Or hopefully you can email it to them, you know. You don't have to actually meet them to give them the exam.
Would you ever do the practice of meeting several applicants at the same time for leveraging your time?
You better believe it, man. In fact, that's one of the strategies I talk about. As your company grows and you need more and more employees, that you have to learn that you don't have to meet with people one-on-one. You can meet with a group of people at one time. You talk to all of them about the job opportunity, the overview of the company, and what the future plans are for the company to create an awareness that this is a great place to work. But then you have them all fill out the test at the same time. Tell them they can wait around to know if they're going to have a chance to be called back, or they can simply call back later that afternoon and see if they're going to have a follow-up interview.
Okay, so you'll look at the results from this test. It's easy to read the results after they take the profiling test?
Oh, yeah. It takes a few minutes to input the data.
All right, and then you'll look at the results, and just based on that and whatever observation you have, what will you do next?
Well, by this time, you've got an application, you've got an employee screening tool, and that you've got a basic skills test, and then they've made it to the point where you've got this ERI that tells you a little bit about the likelihood of them to be honest, and you've got a pretty good idea whether someone is worth talking to. The other thing that's really helpful, I find, you know, is just eliminating people during that meeting. I talked about a group meeting. Group meetings can be really great because you can eliminate people who really are there shopping around but don't know anything about the business or the industry, and they haven't disqualified themselves as of yet. Here's a good example. During my presentation to 50 prospective employees, I put up a photograph on a screen that shows a snake that one of our crews encountered out on a job site. And I simply say, you know, working outside is tough work. It's hot, it's dirty, and sometimes you get exposed to things that you may not enjoy. Things like spiders and snakes. And so if you don't like spiders and snakes, it's really a good idea for you not to apply for this job or continue this application process. And you'd be surprised, Michael, that some people that had not disqualified themselves to that point will say, you know what, I hadn't thought about that. I'm out of here, and simply leave.
All right, let's go back to you've qualified in your group meetings. You've done the personality profiling. You're looking for the high scores. What do you do next once you see a potential superstar? Do you invite them back for a one-on-one or?
Well, I want to put the likelihood that the people that I'm going to talk to would actually take a job before I ever talk to them. So I want to make certain that in that group meeting, I go ahead and talk about the pay and benefits up front.
This is going to be the first time they're going to hear anything about money?
Pay and benefits would be mentioned in any of the ads placed.
And is there a strategy on that?
I'm going to give them a range. I'm going to give a pay range where I would take someone with no experience, no background, first time they've ever been hired as a job, and what I would pay my top man in that same position. I'm going to give them the whole range.
What are you going to tell them as far as pay and benefits? And you're going to do that in the group meeting, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So you're going to try and qualify more people. If they don't think it's enough money, they're out of there.
That's right.
How do you handle the money when you're hiring? Do you pay good? Do you start at minimum? What's your secret for that when it comes to money? I mean, you pay peanuts, you get monkeys?
No, I don't believe that. I think that you've got to find people that fit the culture of the company and who want an opportunity. I don't think that if you pay a low wage starting out that you're going to always end up with bad people. On the contrary, I think it's your job as an employer to sell your company in the future that it offers. The likelihood for continued employment, the likelihood for growth in the company, and the likelihood of increases in pay can be a great motivator for people. I have found in my career that a young person that has yet to discover that they're a superstar will work for the same thing that someone who thinks they're a superstar, but they're really not. That is, if you're going to hire somebody and pay them minimum wage, there's nothing wrong with that if they think they can be making two times that in a short period of time. If you start off, though, paying someone too much to start with, then it's hard to increase them. It's not as easy to increase them as quickly. And so I tend to want to start off for a two-week or a four-week trial period and pay as little as possible, as little as they'll work for.
You're listening to an interview on Michael Senoff's HardToFindSeminars.com.
And that shows something about them, their character, and are they willing to start off that low for the potential?
Exactly. And they say, well, you know, do I trust myself to be a good employee? Do I know that if I come in here, I'm going to make an impact in this company and to this man or this employer over a quick period of time? Those people don't feel like they're going to disappoint. They don't feel like they're going to be stuck at the same pay.
What are you going to tell them as far as pay? And give me the system. So they're going to start off for 2 or 4 weeks on a trial basis at minimum wage. And then after that, what do you promise them? And then tell me what you're promising them based on good performance that they can earn. How do you get that desire for them to go for these raises? You know what I'm saying?
I think it's important to have pay scales within different positions in your company. An entry-level technician is going to earn less money than a person who is a supervisor of other people, who's going to make probably less money than a manager of a small team. And so what I would talk to an entry-level technician about up front in a very first meeting as the steps to go from the technician to the supervisor to the manager and lay out that ladder in front of them so they'll know exactly what they got to do in order to earn the top dollar in your company.
I got you. And do you give them a time frame of how long it would take based on their performance to get to those next steps?
Exactly. And what I always find is using examples of other employees who have taken those same steps, how much time it took them to give them an idea of what others have done.
All right, so why don't you give me an example of one of your guys? A typical employee started off entry-level technician. How long did it take him to get up to where he is now? And start with pay.
I'll give you an example from the landscape business. the entry-level job begins in a landscape technician slot at $7 an hour, and you can go up to $8.50 an hour in this position. And you increase from $7 to $8.50 based on three things. Number one is going to be time with the company. Number two is going to be your ability to learn how to use the different pieces of equipment that you're assigned to use. And then number three, based on customer feedback, that is the clients and what they say about you and the team that you're working on. So we want to make sure that we're getting good feedback all the time from our customers. And then once you have maxed out at that job, you go to a crew leader position. And a crew leader position begins at $8.50 an hour, and it goes up to $14 an hour. And here's how you go from $8 to $14 an hour. Well, at $8.50 an hour, you must have a driver's license and a suitable driving history according to the standards set by our insurance carrier. You see, in order for you to be able to legally drive our vehicles here at this company, you're going to have to submit a driving history report. And if you have speeding violations or DUIs or bad driving habits, you're simply not going to be qualified to move to the next level. So it's very important that you keep your driving history clean in order to move beyond the $8.50 an hour. If you have that suitable driving history, then you're qualified with the technical training, learning the tools, then you would be assigned a crew. You could move to a crew leader position at $8.50 an hour. From there, you can go up to $10 an hour based on whether you're doing, we call them residential crews or commercial crews, which is basically the size of accounts. And then we have got carrots hanging out here. Basically, you begin working on certifications. If you become a licensed pesticide applicator, and here's the test that you have to take, here are the dates it's going to be administered, then you're going to get paid an additional dollar an hour. That's $2,000 a year based on a 40-hour work week.
They don't have to pay for those tests, do they?
They don't even have to pay for the test. That's right. They actually get paid to go to classes, to get ready to take the test, and the tuition for the test. The company will pay them back for it as long as they pass it.
And if they don't pass it?
Then they have paid for it.
What do those cost, those tests?
It can be from $45 to about $200, depending on the level of certification.
Oh, I see. And if they fail, you take it from their pay, or?
Yeah, yeah.
That's fair. Can they study up on that?
Oh, sure, yeah. I mean, we'll buy the books. We'll provide the books at no charge to them. But when it comes to paying the fee for the exam, I found that if they don't pay the fee, they will not study and take it seriously. But if they put $40 or $50 or $200 on the line, they'll get a lot more serious about studying and preparing to pass the exam. And look at what's in it for them. If you pay somebody just a dollar more per hour and they work a full-time schedule, that's $2,000 a year. And when we lay out, here's three certification tests that you can take, and each one of them is worth another dollar an hour to you. And so there's a way to get an additional $6,000 a year. Now, you'll have to demonstrate some technical competency along the way. You'll have to study some at night, practice what you learn on the job. But here's exactly how you're going to increase your pay, from $25,000 to $32,000. Something like that.
All right. Tell me about benefits other than the hourly fee and the potential for growing with the company. What kind of benefits do you offer that try and keep that retention up?
Well, to start with, Michael, I recommend having I call it employee retention bonus. An employee retention bonus is simply a scheduled anniversary bonus. And what this says is that if you've been with my company for 1 year, you're going to get an additional $200 or $400 or $600 depending on how many years you've been with the company. You see, having 1 year with the business, a person has overcome a lot of hurdles, learning technical issues about the work of your company. But after someone's been there for a year, they become a much greater, much more valuable employee in my view. They've gotten themselves trained in several areas. They've proven themselves from a dependability standpoint to a large degree. And so I want to make it a big deal just that they've been there for a year.
Yeah, they're a real asset. 1 year working with you, they know everything. Explain to the listeners how expensive it is to train. It is expensive to hire and train, isn't it?
Well, as part of the strategy for retaining employees, I simply don't think that you've got to give away your company or promise people thousands of dollars in bonuses just to stay. I think the most important thing is to help people continue to learn. And so laying out to a prospective employee in writing exactly the process for getting promotions within the company and the approximate value of those promotions in dollars and cents up front when you hire them sets the stage for retention. And then retention is confirmed or aided dramatically when you provide them with training, investing money in them for training. We had in my landscaping business a terrific workforce with an average tenure of 3 years across the entry-level field workers and crew leaders, which was just phenomenal compared to our industry. And I firmly believe that one of the reasons we were able to keep people staying there, working for that amount of time, was the fact that each and every year we would have specific training events within our company, at our shop, half-day event, where we would bring in someone from the outside of the company to teach technical skills. But then we'd also spend one day a year where we would go to an industry-specific trade show or educational event and have them sit through a class taught by university-level instructors or business consultants. And just the participation away from the office in a professional environment helps people respect their job, respect their company, and say, hey, this person's investing in me. I think this is a good place to stay and work.
Other than the bonuses and other than the training, any other tips for employers to help maintain employee retention?
Well, I'll tell you something that is really helpful. Having a retirement program or talking about retirement is a smart thing to do. And many small business owners overlook the fact that they can set up a simple IRA program for almost nothing. It really doesn't cost much at all to meet with a financial advisor and to set up a simple IRA program for your company. Now, a simple IRA will cost you, the employer, a little bit of money. But here's the best news about it. Having a retirement program in place at your company helps increase the likelihood that people are going to stay for a long, long time. A simple IRA is a great benefit to you, the employer, as well, not just the employee, because when you have a simple IRA, the basic rules are, and I'm not a retirement plan expert, but I will tell you that if you have a simple IRA, the company will match up to 3% of the gross wages of an employee. So if a person makes $30,000 a year and they contribute 3% of their wages or $900 towards a retirement program, then the company will also match $900 towards this employee's retirement program. But if the employee is not all that interested in putting money towards retirement, they don't put $900 or 3% or 1% or anything, then you, the employer, don't have to put anything either. So it doesn't cost you a thing. But the great news is that you, the owner of the company, can increase the amount of money you put into your retirement program from a standard IRA of $4,000 or $5,000 up to $11,000 or $12,000 as the owner of the company. So you gain a benefit of being able to put more money into your retirement. Plus, if an employee does choose to put 3% of their wages into this retirement program, you, the employer, actually have to spend less money on employee benefits from Medicare and Social Security benefits. So the $900, you don't have to pay Social Security and Medicare benefits on. So it costs you less than $900, actually, to have the program in place for that employee.
Give me one more strategy for retaining employees, and then let's talk about the actual hiring process. Once you've identified a good candidate and you want to invite them to become an employee, I want to hear the process of how you handle that. But first, give me another strategy or tactic for retaining.
Well, let's just say that an employee is a real superstar. They're going to care about where they work. You will know that from meeting with them because they're going to ask you questions about what you're going to do for them. And something that you can do with key employees, people that are going to become true superstars, that you're going to want to build a business around them for many, many years, you can set up another vehicle or retirement program around life insurance. A life insurance policy with a written vesting schedule. Now, do you know what I mean when I say written vesting schedule, Michael?
No.
Well, basically, let's just say you have someone who's going to become a manager in your company, and you want them to stay with your company for a long time. One of the benefits that you can set up is you can buy a life insurance policy for them. It may have a face value of $100,000 or $500,000 or $1 million, depending on the situation with this employee. Say the policy premium is $4,000 a year. You, the employer, provide that as a benefit. However, you, the employer, own that insurance policy, and every year that the employee stays with your company, they begin to own more and more of that policy.
Okay.
A written vesting schedule might go like this. Michael, I'm going to offer you this position to come to work here at my company, and one of the benefits I'm going to offer you is that I'm going to buy a $500,000 whole life insurance policy. Now, this will give you the comfort to know that in the event of your untimely death, your wife, your children will be paid this $500,000 benefit. I'm going to buy this whole life insurance policy, Michael, and it's going to cost me $6,000 a year, $500 per month. And each and every year over the next 5 years, you're going to gain ownership of 20% of that policy. So 5 years from now, you will be vested 100%. You follow that 20% year one, 40% year two, 60% year three, 80% year four, and 100% year five. During this time that I have provided you with this $500,000 of whole life insurance, and I'm paying the premiums on your behalf, there will be cash value that's building in this insurance policy. And after you own the policy 100%, you've got some choices to make. Number one, you can take the cash value or the money that's accumulated in the policy and use it to buy a new home if you want to. Use it to pay for a kid's school, a college education if you need to. You can leave it there and let it continue to grow, but you own it after 5 years. That's a sample of a little bit more sophisticated retirement program that someone can set up within a small business and not have to provide it to every single employee.
You would not offer that to every employee, or you would?
I would not. That would be something I would offer to management-level people.
And when you're talking about some of the benefits, you can mention once you get to this level, we could offer that to you.
That's right.
And that would cost you, you don't get any discounts on that policy, that is going to cost you $6,000 a year.
And you're going to pay for that. That's right. What you do is, again, you get people thinking from day one. And I think that's a big mistake that owners make when they're trying to hire people, and particularly when they're trying to find superstars, is that they think, oh, I got to have somebody now, but yet they don't think about talking about 3, 5, or more years down the road. I think that's a real key part of finding those real superstars out there.
Someone who's invested a couple years into that policy, they're going to think twice about leaving.
That's right.
Yeah, that's all retention. That's good. So what about when you're ready to hire? Let's say you see an applicant, they've passed all the tests, and how do you invite them to be an employee at your company?
Always, always provide a potential employee an offer in writing. When you provide an offer in writing, they know you're serious, they know you're professional. This is particularly impactful on entry-level employees. Think about it like this. When a person graduates from high school or college, they get ready to enter the real world. They're after their first serious job. Well, those people that are going to be real superstars, they're going to be a little more concerned about the future. And when you provide information in writing and someone else doesn't, you gain a competitive edge to lure them in to your business. And so providing it in writing is very important. But then spell out those benefits that they can work their way into, as well as the ones that are mandated by the federal government. You know what? Every employer in America that hires someone is required to pay Medicare insurance and Social Security insurance. But many, many employers fail to point out that they, the employer, are contributing towards that employee's retirement program with Social Security payments that they make on the employee's behalf. And so that little detail may point out that you're paying more than a competitor would be.
Yeah, so you put that in the form of a letter and you mail that to the applicant.
I prefer to provide the offers in person to see the reaction.
Oh, I see. You'll ask them to come in and then you have it all laid out in writing.
It's all laid out.
And you present it to them.
You present it to them. I simply say, look, I'm prepared to offer you a job. Got all the details here in writing. And what I thought I would do is just give this to you right now, give you a chance to read through it. I'm going to step out of the office. I'll come back in about 10 minutes. You'll have time to read it by then. You can take some notes here in the margins if you'd like and get ready to ask me a few questions. And just put them at ease, put them by themselves. You don't have to make a decision today, but I want to give you the chance to reflect upon this yourself, come up with some questions, and then we'll talk about it. Does that sound fair? Everybody, of course, says yes. It sounds fair. But you make the event a big deal. Coming to work at your company is not just a job. It's the potential for a career, a place that someone would want to work for many, many years, perhaps a lifetime.
Very good, very good. One other question I was curious. Do you have your employees do a drug testing?
Yes, as part of the process of stepping up in the company, there is a federal law that says if someone is going to drive a vehicle that has a gross vehicle weight rating of over 10,000 pounds, they have to be able to pass a DOT physical. That's DOT as in Department of Transportation. And that DOT physical includes a drug screening.
So at what point do you do that in the process?
I would do that before I would hire them. That is, I would make the job offer contingent upon them passing the DOT physical.
Okay. Have you found that to be a problem? You've presented offers and you make that contingent and then they fail it?
Oh, sure. Yes, it happens. You know, some people have bad habits on the weekends, you know.
So there's no way to streamline that before you make the hiring offer?
You can. I mean, you could ask somebody to take the drug screening before you make them an offer. I mean, that's basically what I'm doing right there. But I've never asked them to take a drug screening before I made them an offer. Never have. I've said your offer is contingent upon and then have them take it before you actually hire them. But I spent some time qualifying somebody and interviewing somebody. You know, one case, it wasn't drugs or anything like that, but a guy had a bad heart. You know, they do his little stress test when they do that DOT physical. I had another case where a guy hired, he was a perfect candidate, but he had bad eyes. He couldn't see well enough. Didn't have glasses or whatever, needed corrective lenses, and he didn't have them.
Now, does the employee pay for that?
No.
You pay for that?
I pay for
that. What does that cost?
It's $80.
$80, okay, okay. Well, let's summarize what we've covered. Give me an overview, the short version of what small business owners can do to find superstar employees and keep them, and then we're going to talk about how people can contact you.
Well, number one, it begins with using multiple strategies to get a lot of people coming to you. The second part is that just because someone applies for your company doesn't make them qualified and doesn't mean you should spend any time considering them unless they can pass a basic skills test and then some type of pre-employment screening test so that you can learn a bit about their background. I think it's very important to use a pre-screening tool such as a basic skills test, such as a pre-employment personality test, and checking with prior employers before you spend 1 minute of your time interviewing somebody. I think that it is very important to interview someone, but only after you have spent some time doing pre-interview screening. And the reason I like that, Michael, is because the pre-employment screening can be done by just about anybody in the company. You know, you can have a secretary call and follow up. You can have a secretary or an assistant score a test. You can have them call and ask 3 questions of a previous employer and write down those answers. You can do a lot of this pre-screening with other people in the organization. And then if someone is truly qualified, then consider using a group environment to build awareness about what the job truly is and what the potential is for working at the company. And that way you maximize your time as an employer, focusing on the other things that take up your time in the business. And then when you narrow the field, make sure you provide an offer in writing and spell out what the next 3 to 5 years is going to look like in the company. Think long term. Think longer term than what you think today about the potential of this employee.
So your book, 50 Ways to Find, Recruit, Hire, and Retain Superstar Employees, is that book going to give me in more detail a lot of the information we've been talking about?
Yes, it is. We go into a number of things, Michael, that we haven't talked about, strategies for getting into schools, colleges, technical schools, universities, how to recruit superstars from those organizations, and even talk about a couple of rather, I should say, controversial types of sources for people, the government programs, the strategies for getting government assistance for employees. It's a pretty comprehensive book.
What does this book sell for?
The book comes complete in print with an audio program, and it's $99.
$99. That's a drop in the bucket if one can use one little technique in there for hiring, whether they save money from running classified ads or whether they have a way to qualify a prospect and retaining employees. That sounds like a pretty good deal to me. Now, what other services do you offer if someone listening to this wants to contact you? What would be the best way for them to contact you or to find out how they can order this book?
Michael, you can contact Tony Bass by visiting my website at www.tonybassconsulting.com. T-O-N-Y-B-A-S-S consulting, C-O-N-S-U-L-T-I-N-G.com.
And how about a phone number for those people who like to pick up the phone?
Phone number is 478-822-9706. Again, 478-822-9706.
Thanks for listening to this interview with Tony Bass. I hope it's been helpful. If you're interested in learning more or finding his book, please contact me at michael@michaelsenoff.com, or you can go to amazon.com, search Tony Bass, and you'll find his books. Thanks for listening. For more interviews like this, go to hardtofindseminars.com.